We know there are at least 5 people in the Greenwich Village townhouse explosion. Terry Robbins, Diana Outen, Ted Gold, Kathy Boudin, and Kathy Wilkerson. 56 years later, Kathy Wilkerson is the only one still alive. She's the last person who can tell us what happened that day. It was her father's townhouse where they built the bombs. So, we're sending her a letter.
Dear Kathy, our names are Chloe Stein and Eleanor Barzin, and we're both journalists at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. This
semester, Kathy Wilkerson fled the explosion alongside Kathy Boudin. She spent the next decade underground, evading the FBI, landing on its top 10 most wanted list. In the nearly 6 decades since, she's rarely agreed to talk about what happened.
We just moved to New York City this past fall. We're about the same age you were when you joined the movement, and we noticed the parallels between the political climate that existed in the 1960s and 70s and now.
We want to know if she regrets it. Joining the Weathermen, taking part in the revolution, letting her comrades use her father's townhouse, and everything that followed.
What would you tell young people, us, today?
Those were a lot of the questions we had when we sent that letter. It arrived on Monday, February 16th. And on that same day, we get an email.
I can't believe it. Okay, I'm gonna read it out loud. Greetings, Chloe and Eleanor. I look forward to a phone call to get to know each other and work out details.
We found her.
Kathleen Wilkerson.
Kathleen Wilkerson.
Miss Wilkerson. Wilkerson.
Kathy Wilkerson.
Kathleen Wilkerson was one of the most wanted fugitives in the country.
I've spent my life trying to figure out how I could have done this.
I'm Chloe Stein.
And I'm Eleanor Barzin.
And this is Shoe Leather, a podcast that digs up stories about New York City's past to find out how yesterday's news affects us today. This season, we're going to 1970 Greenwich Village. A townhouse suddenly explodes, and authorities find out that it's ground zero for the operations of the Weathermen, a radical group of young revolutionaries who use violence to bring the war home. This is Shoe Leather Season 7, Revolution Gone Wrong. You're listening to the final episode, Episode 6, The Survivor.
Six weeks after Kathy got our letter, she finally agrees to meet us. A 2.5-hour train ride later, we're at a library upstate. Kathy's 81 now, and a grandmother. She's a retired math teacher. She's very low-tech and has zero online presence. She seems to prefer it this way. It's our first time seeing her in person, and it's hard to imagine this woman being on the FBI's top 10 most wanted list. She's around 5'5", maybe a little hunched over. She still looks like the hippie she once was, wearing a flannel and carrying a patchwork bag, but now with short, gray hair. She's a little intense, but has a sense of humor. But we want to know how she got from that townhouse in Greenwich Village, running, to sitting here with us in a library. That's the story we need her to tell. So we start at the beginning.
I've really been political my whole life. But children have this problem, which is universally, children have a very strong sense of fairness. So I started noticing things that weren't fair. I didn't get why some people were poor and some people were rich, and my parents did not have a reasonable explanation for that.
Like the others in the townhouse, Kathy comes from an affluent middle-class family. And like the others, she goes off to college. She gets into campus politics early, joining Students for a Democratic Society, or SDS, and she quickly rises into leadership. She's also part of the faction that breaks away from SDS to form a more radical offshoot they call the Weathermen. It's in that group that she meets a guy, a young man who will change the trajectory of her life. Terry Robbins.
You know, we had begun sort of, I mean, dating is really not the right word, but working, talking to each other in December. But we had had a, you know, one of those magical connections.
By early 1970, Kathy's living in Seattle. Terry's just been released from prison in Cleveland.
He called me and he said, do you want to come east and so we can be together? And I said, sure. And I hopped on a plane and came.
But Terry isn't calling just to be romantic. He has plans, and he needs Kathy's help. He's helping the leadership of the Weathermen assemble a small group, a collective, as they call it, to build bombs, to target symbols of American power, to bring the war home.
It was a hand-picked group by the leadership of Weathermen, which was basically a friend group, a long-standing group of intense friends.
They're gathering in New York City, and they need somewhere to crash. She offers up her father's townhouse while he's away on vacation in the Caribbean. She tells him she's sick and needs a comfortable place to stay. She's lying, but he agrees. She leaves a note on the front door so that neighbors won't bother them. Up to this point, the story sounds coordinated, like a group of friends working together. But Kathy remembers it differently.
My role was not clear. I was in this group of five people who were sort of a secondary leadership, mostly by virtue of our age and experience. We didn't have a relationship with each other at all. We did not talk.
Five people, a high-stakes plan, and by her account, almost no trust holding it together. It's hard to believe, but the group dynamic in the townhouse is pretty unconventional. In the Weathermen, there is no such thing as monogamy. Terry Robbins is dating Kathy, but he's also involved with another woman in the townhouse, Diana Outen. And Diana is dating Terry's best friend. And Terry pressures Kathy into a sexual encounter with another woman there. Kathy doesn't say whom. Kathy also says that at first, she doesn't know what Terry and the others want to use the townhouse for. What police will later describe as a bomb factory. But that's the plan that's set in motion. The way she recalls it, the bombs are intended for a non-commissioned officer's dance at Fort Dix in New Jersey, an army base where American soldiers pass through on their way to Vietnam. You'll remember, back in episode 4, there are conflicting reports about the intended target of the bomb, whether it was Columbia University or Fort Dix. Kathy's clear, it was Fort Dix.
But this thing at the officers' club, there was a public dance, and we had, at least I had no idea, and I was not present for any discussions like how they would get on the base and whether anybody could just walk in and say, I'm going to the party. You know, it was seemed pretty unrealistic to me, but hey, I didn't know. And I was not involved in that piece. But my understanding was it was directed to a coat closet. And that was the reason for the nails in the bomb, was to try to cause a lot of damage in the closet.
Kathy says the bombs weren't meant to hurt anyone, just damage property.
Was that stupid? Was it politically horrible? Was it incredibly unsafe? Could there have been a possibility of somebody getting really hurt or even conceivably killed? Absolutely.
Kathy's right. The bombs could have killed someone. Just listen to how these devices are built. Dynamite. Heavy roofing nails taped around the dynamite sticks to act as shrapnel. All of it packed into metal pipes and wired to cheap alarm clocks. Nails are a strange choice if you don't intend to harm. And this is the recipe that will end up leaving Terry Robbins' body so mangled that it can't be formally identified.
It's March 6, 1970. The group of five has stayed in the townhouse for the past week. Kathy's father is supposed to arrive home today, so she's trying to clean up and return the townhouse to its neat and orderly state. She's on the main floor ironing sheets. And then it happens.
When the explosion happened, the house sort of completely disintegrated, and there was no walls, no floors, nothing.
Kathy hears a woman, Kathy Boudin, calling out for her.
Kathy cried out that she couldn't see, which was because there was all this dust. But I knew pretty quick that we had about 45 seconds to get out of the building, and that was it. So I clawed my way over to her, grabbed her hand. We walked out. There was no doors or windows left, but there was a gaping hole in the front. We went out that way.
People are already starting to gather.
I think her name was Mrs. Wagner, who lived down the block, said, you know, come down to my house. And she took us because Kathy had been in the shower, so she didn't have any clothes on. She was really in shock. And so people tried to put stuff on her. She was having none of it. So they got a coat wrapped around her, and we went down to Mrs. Wagner's house. We jumped in the shower because we were both completely covered in dust and soot. She had generously laid out some of her old own clothes on the bed for us to put on.
One of those items that Mrs. Wagner had laid out was a pair of pink patent leather boots.
We showered really quickly and got dressed really quickly, and we knew that it was a matter of minutes before the police would come.
Once the two Kathys dress and are out of sight from Mrs. Wagner, they leave the guest room and enter the nearby primary bedroom. In there, they peer into a closet and rummage through the pockets of the hanging clothes.
We found a subway token back in the day in one of the pockets.
The subway token gives them the means to leave. But on their way out, they run into Mrs. Wagner's housekeeper. They convince her that they need to immediately go to a nearby drugstore so that they can get medicine for their scrapes.
And we took off and went through the turnstile together. We were both in shock to some extent and, you know, tried to figure out what to do next, where to go.
And where did you go?
Well, I'm not going to go into that. She went with the leadership and I went elsewhere.
She's 81 and still protecting people. Like that old weatherman code of silence never really ended. Like they're all still comrades. But back to this moment, the fallout from the townhouse explosion. She's 25 when she goes underground and disappears for a decade. And she won't speak to her family once in that time. No letters, no phone calls, no nothing.
It was a most unlikely location for a revolutionary conspiracy. And so when the home of wealthy advertising and radio executive James Platt Wilkerson was torn by explosion and fire last Friday, authorities first assumed an accidental detonation in a gas line had been responsible, except that the blast had been just too powerful. And then it turned out that Wilkerson's 25-year-old daughter, Catherine, who was seen after the explosion but who then vanished, had been active in the Weatherman faction of SDS.
On March 12th, 6 days after the explosion, Kathy's parents are on the front page of the New York Times. The lead of the story is the parents of a 25-year-old woman missing from a demolished Greenwich Village home, where the police said a militant left-wing group was fashioning bombs, made an impassioned plea to their daughter yesterday to disclose how many people were in the building at the time of the blast. Authorities suspected it was more than just the five of them. Within the first day of the explosion, the body of Ted Gold is identified. It hadn't occurred to Kathy that Ted was in the wreckage. She thought he'd already left the house to go to a drugstore. Shortly after Ted, Diana Outen's body is also identified. And later, it becomes understood that Terry is the other victim. Kathy doesn't come forward. And now the authorities' hunt for her begins. The FBI keeps track of the aliases she uses. Dorothy Coletta, Rebecca DeAnda, and Judy Flores. In her file, they write that she, quote, may wear horn-rimmed glasses, reportedly plays harp and guitar, as if any of that would be the thing to give her away. But they don't catch her. They never will.
The townhouse explosion and the two Kathys' escape is what launches a whole new era of the Weathermen. The other members scatter into hiding and start living nomadic lives. They rename themselves the Weather Underground Organization. Kathy moves from city to city, building new lives over and over. She still won't say exactly where. And even after three people have just died in the townhouse, the Weather Underground's bombings don't stop. They keep building devices, perfecting the design. Around 15 more bombings happen, but they don't kill a single other person. That's not the goal. They want attention.
The Associated Press in Washington today received a 5-page typewritten letter in which an organization calling itself the Weather Underground said it had bombed the Capitol yesterday.
They plant homemade bombs in office buildings and other crowded places, then call ahead, to receptionists, front desks, to warn people to clear out. Kathy has a blunt way of describing this era of the Weather Underground.
It was an organization that had this one little gig of making these little devices and planting them in bathrooms. And it was politically bankrupt. I mean, I don't know how to say it any nicer than that. It wasn't a conspiracy. It's not like there was people that set out to do bad things. It was bad politics. It was bad behavior.
We ask her if she was one of those people involved in the, quote, bad behavior. So to what extent were you involved in hands-on building of bombs after you went underground?
The building of the devices was not a big deal. Somebody made a much safer design, and then once that existed, anybody could do it.
She doesn't really answer the question. And maybe the mechanics got simpler, but Kathy's life doesn't.
In March of 1977, after 7 years underground, her priorities changed dramatically. Her life stops feeling like an act of resistance. It starts to feel like survival. Kathy has a baby.
My complete focus at that point was to try to keep my daughter safe.
Her daughter, Bessie. Kathy describes how difficult it was to raise a child while still in hiding.
Those years were physically really hard because of the physical demands of the situation, you know, running blocks to get from daycare, which didn't open until 8:30, to my job, which I was supposed to be at 8:30. Living in the communities that I lived in, I got mugged like 3 or 4 times. And every single time I was holding an infant and they ripped the backpack off my back and ran away.
And all that was in it was dirty diapers. She keeps moving, keeps working. But once Bessie's old enough to start preschool, Kathy realizes she can't live like this anymore. By 1977, the Weather Underground is basically dissolved. The Vietnam War is over. And Kathy has grown to resent the people speaking as the organization's leaders.
And when the Weathermen fell apart, I was so happy.
Kathy's been on the run to avoid prison, to stay politically radical. But there isn't really anything to fight for anymore. The organization she's a part of is no longer relevant.
But then it became, like, stupid. And I was aware that it was kind of stupid, but I was stuck in this situation.
Up to now, Kathy's life has been about staying hidden. What happens next is the opposite. She walks straight towards the people looking for her. She decides to turn herself in.
So it seemed like a good time to take the risk. I knew that I was facing anywhere up to 10 years in prison, so it was very hard because of my daughter. But it seemed like it wasn't going to get any better. And so at this point, I had to make that decision.
First, she finds a lawyer.
I knew I wanted a woman lawyer. I was not having the men anymore.
And on July 8th, 1980, Kathy surrenders to the Manhattan District Attorney.
Today, Kathy Wilkerson walked into the District Attorney's office in Manhattan.
After a decade evading law enforcement, still aiding in the bombings of office buildings, Kathy can only be convicted for one thing: possession of dynamite from when she was in her father's townhouse. That's it. There are a few reasons for this. By the time Kathy turns herself in, it's been almost a decade since the explosion. Too much time has passed. On top of that, the FBI had used some illegal tactics during their hunt for her, so the bulk of the case against Kathy kind of falls apart. Kathy pleads guilty to the dynamite charge and is sentenced to 3 years in prison. And there's parts of prison she likes.
Well, if I hadn't had a daughter, I would have stayed longer. For me, I was exhausted, so I didn't mind sleeping. I was really happy to sleep and have time to read. I hadn't had time to read a book for years.
Kathy only serves 11 months of her sentence. Then she's out. From here on, Kathy Wilkerson isn't a fugitive anymore. She goes back to a life where she can mostly blend in. For a long time, she's mostly silent. Until 26 years later. It's 2007, and Kathy releases her memoir. Her memoir is a dense, chronological account of how she grew up in an affluent neighborhood in Connecticut, a Catholic school education, divorced parents, and her political radicalization. And maybe around 75% of it is dedicated to the years before the townhouse explosion ever happens. Hundreds of pages go by, laying out the why, the context, the justifications. And when she finally gets there, to the townhouse, she describes her mental state as, quote, a fog.
It feels like there's still something she isn't quite addressing. What the intentions really were, how far the group was willing to go. In all of our reporting, we'd never found any statement that the bomb was only meant for a closet. We asked Kathy why her version sounds so different.
So you talked about how the bomb, at least in the townhouse, wasn't meant to kill anybody, and that to your memory or understanding, it was hopefully going to be left in a closet. And so when we've read reports, you're the only person we've heard say that. And I know you were saying, you know, there wasn't this grand understanding, but some people might be thinking that someone in your position would be trying to rewrite the history. So what would you say to someone who believes that?
History is what you make of it. And all I can do is tell my story based on what I knew and at the time. Based on everything I've said, it's very obvious that I'm not trying to rewrite the history in some glamorous way or self-aggrandizing way, because there's not much that I could work with in the self-aggrandizing department. So, I'm telling the story the way that I can tell it. That's all I can do.
Would you do it all over again?
Do what? I would be political my whole life again. I would be outraged and angry. But, I understand a lot more now. So, no to that part. But do I regret? No.
It's a striking response. Owning some decisions, but disavowing others. She's lived a long life. Can you really regret every choice that's led you to now? Or can you cherry pick? And it leaves that day, March 6, 1970, to live in kind of a gray area. But we're not really satisfied with that.
Over a month after our last conversation with Kathy, we schedule another interview with her, this time over Zoom. We want to clarify what she regrets and what she doesn't. But hindsight's complicated. Her responses are never going to be the same on any given day. And that makes sense. Even 56 years later, This chapter of her life is a lot to emotionally unpack. So we want to ask her really simply this time.
Hi, Kathy.
Hey, Kathy.
Hi, can you see me?
We jump right into it.
So I asked you if you would do it all over again, and you said, do I regret? No. Just so we're precise, what is that no about?
Do I regret doing the best I could, even though it meant making some mistakes? And the answer to that is no.
So do you regret ever joining the Weathermen?
Yes, completely.
Do you regret that your father's townhouse was used?
Yes, because I kept a very hard line between involving my family. And so I totally regret that.
To what extent, if any, do you feel responsible for the deaths that happened in the townhouse?
I feel totally responsible. I mean, not that I caused them. I wasn't a leader in that situation, but to not say louder, because I did say it, but I didn't say it very loud. This is crazy. We cannot run into this so quickly. We don't know what we're doing. And I could have said that, and I didn't say it. So I totally hold myself responsible.
After the explosion, do you regret running and not turning yourself in immediately?
Not a bit. I mean, because it would have been an impossible situation for everybody, not just for me, but for my family, for the movement. So best to get out of it temporarily.
How often do you think about what happened on March 6, 1970?
Every day. I mean, it never goes away.
She says it never goes away, that the past is closer than we care to admit. And Kathy sees something in this moment, 2026, that looks familiar to her. The anger, the sense that the system isn't working.
Kathy didn't have to ever talk to us. She said no to a lot of reporters over the years. But she answered our letter. And then she kept talking, over several months, far more conversations than we'd ever expected. At some point, we ask her why. She says she isn't talking to us just as journalists, but as young people on a college campus.
News to tell you about right now. Within the last few minutes, Columbia University directing NYPD onto their campus to remove protesters who refuse to leave the school's library. Now you can see
are still underway as we speak. So far, I've counted 78 people ushered out by the NYPD.
At least the fourth Columbia University student to be detained by the Department of Homeland Security, leaving this campus on edge.
The fights change, the politics shift, but every generation seems to arrive at some version of the same question. What do you do when you believe the world is fundamentally wrong?
For the Weathermen, the answer was to form a community, a manifesto, a unified purpose. They used Bob Dylan's 1965 song, Subterranean Homesick Blues, to create a name, hoping to carve it into history.
John is in the basement mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement looking by the government. A man in a trench.
They were revolutionaries trying to confront the same tension we still live with, fighting the world as it is, while still believing it can change. So we asked Kathy how she feels about this current world, if she thinks it can change.
It depends on what the weather is, how I answer this on any given day. Mostly, I feel hopeful.
Shoe Leather is a production of the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism.
This episode was reported, written, and produced by me, Chloe Stein.
And me, Eleanor Barzin.
Joanne Farrian is our executive producer and professor. Rachel Quester and Peter Leonard are our co-professors. Special thanks to Emily Schmidt, Austin Mitchell, Brendan Klinkenberg, Asta Chaturvedi, Dana Shivas, Zoe Chase, Brent Katz, and Columbia Digital Libraries. Sources for this episode include Kathy Wilkerson's memoir, Flying Close to the Sun, My Life and Times as a Weatherman, and Sam Green and Bill Siegel's documentary film, The Weather Underground. Shoe Leather's theme music, Squeegees, is by Ben Lewis, Duran Zunes, and Camille Miller, remixed by Peter Leonard. Other music by Blue Dot Sessions. Our Season 7 graphic was created by Hope Zoo.